Now, the Radio Experience Special. From National Public Radio, Joe Frank in concert.
So I was on the IRT, Lexington Avenue, local, going uptown. I was sitting next to a blind man who'd been on the train when I boarded at Canal Street. We sat next to each other as the train stopped at Spring Street, Astor Place, 14th, 23rd, 28th, 33rd, Grand Central, 51st, 59th, 68th, 77th. As we pulled out of 77th Street, I wondered if he'd lost track of the stops. Wanted to know what station was coming up next. So as we came into 86th Street, I leaned over and said into his ear, 86th Street. And he turned to me and replied,
I'm not dead!
It's called Yorkville. But from here, you can look down and see some of the clubs and restaurants. There's Bremen House. A little further down, the Lorelei Hofbräu. And down there on the corner is the Alpine Inn that was built in the late 19th century. Has a very evocative atmosphere. Dark wood paneled walls, thick embroidered tapestries, exposed beams. It's a large stone fireplace with a coat of arms hanging above it. And you can imagine skidding in a spray of snow next to an empty table on the terrace and ordering a bottle of schnapps.
I have a recurring dream. In it, I'm sitting at a raucous dinner party, concentrating on fruit pits, chicken bones, grease stains, the wine at the bottom of glasses. A woman I've known for years sits across from me, bleeding through her nostrils. I hand her a pair of cotton balls. Then I begin, well, actually, I get something caught in my throat, some dust or something, and I begin coughing. But everybody thinks I'm barking. They don't understand that I'm only trying to clear my throat. Finally, in disgust, they let me out the kitchen door. I wander around the backyard, sniffing at bushes, when I see two arms and two legs sticking out of a sandhill.
Once I had a married couple with a baby that used to live in the apartment next to mine. The husband worked in an office downtown. And every evening when he'd come home, I could hear the baby crying and could hear his wife complaining. I could never make out really what she was saying, but she always sounded very, very upset. And then one evening, after he'd arrived home, I heard the baby shrieking and his wife carrying on again. And this went on for about an hour or so when all of a sudden I began to hear his voice, a voice that I'd really never heard before, repeating over and over again, no, 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 no. It got louder and louder and louder, and quite striking.
Well, the first thing I do whenever I come home is I stick a frozen duck dinner into the oven, and then I sit down to read the evening paper. Tonight, it's a story of a suicide who fell through the windshield of a car, killing the driver, who happened to be on the way to his own wedding. It's a story of a marriage counselor who was arrested for the murder of the man who'd been dating his estranged wife. And another story of a growing number of bodies that have been found in restrooms around the city with their heads miraculously missing. There are also the usual stories of innocent people blown up by terrorist bombs in outdoor cafes and roof gardens, of kids playing on elevators trip and fall to their deaths, of good Samaritans who try to break up fights and get killed. A story that particularly intrigues me is that of a handbag manufacturer who, on an outing with some clients, fell into the alligator pit in the zoo. So, anyway, when the TV dinner is finished, I sit down in front of my television set. The truth of the matter is, I watch a whole lot of television. My favorite program features an undercover detective who uses various disguises to snare his victims. He'll dress like a construction worker, a waitress, a businessman, or a bum. And each drama builds to a violent conclusion as he closes in on an unscrupulous criminal who finally, with his back against the wall like a cornered rat, lashes out in a last desperate attempt to escape. Shots are fired. There's a chase down an alley, through the interior of a warehouse, and then up onto a rooftop. Then a vicious struggle takes place in which random weapons are used. A poker, an anvil, a tire iron, a brick. Until the criminal is subdued. Or even killed. The detective, looking somewhat rumpled, adjusts his tie, explains how he did it to the old chief inspector, and accepts the embraces of his gal Friday, the love interest of the program. Now, during the show, I identify with the detective, and I'm able to escape from my feelings of emptiness. But when it's over, I find myself back in my small apartment, the same person I was before. Nothing has changed in my life. An hour has passed meaninglessly, and my depression returns. I comfort myself by thinking that there is nothing to envy in this program, because it's unreal. The detective is just an actor. People like him don't really exist. Everybody has insecurities, hang-ups, neuroses. Then, one night, I see the actor who plays the detective on a popular late-night talk show. And I note that although he's still handsome, he projects a feeling of uneasiness now that he doesn't have a script to read from, and he tries to sort of force himself to make jokes, clever jokes, and they fall flat. He talks about his 26-acre estate at Malibu. And then he mentions that he often unwinds at a bar downtown called the Hero Lounge. And I suddenly recall the story of another actor who played a detective in a long-running series who was constantly being beaten up in bars and restaurants. A thought occurs to me. The Hero Lounge. I make sure to remember the name. The leading story on the news tonight is that of a Minneapolis house painter who climbed into a church tower, aimed his rifle down into the street, and shot down 12 people at random before himself being killed. His neighbors are interviewed. Predictably, they tell the reporter what a gentle, unassuming, and considerate person he was. A churchgoer. A family man. They shake their heads, baffled. I'm a soft-spoken, self-effacing person. My friends consider me sensitive, compassionate. I love animals and children. I help old folks and the blind across the streets. I'm a cold and windy day, I'll let other people board a crowded bus ahead of me, watch the doors close in my face, and feel the huge tires crush the small bones in my feet. I'm always willing to yield up my own interests to those of others. No, you know, you go. You have a good time. Here, take the tickets. I'll stay at home. Don't worry about me. I'll watch television. I'm all right. Go on. Have a good time. Don't worry. I'm okay. Really. Don't feel bad. I'm a really sweet guy. But inside my car, insulated from contact with other human beings, I'm transformed. I drive hard and fast, speeding along the streets of my city, bearing down upon other cars, cutting them off, terrorizing pedestrians. I drive without pity. Tonight, I drive down to the Hero Lounge. In my pocket are a pair of brass knuckles I bought on the strip. The room is hot, smoky, crowded. I'm alone. Standing next to the bar, a cigarette stuck in the side of my mouth. I suck on it, my cheeks hollowing, squinting. I'm wearing a pair of jeans, boots, blue denim shirt open at the collar. A pair of sunglasses. I feel larger than life, as if I'm on TV screens across America, the hero of a film being observed by an invisible audience of millions. The crowd around me made up of extras, hired to dance, loiter, talk to one another, all of them incidental and unimportant, providing a background against which my story will unfold. I mash the butt out into an ashtray and reach for my drink. I lift it to my lips and sip slowly, gazing casually around the room. And I recognize the familiar faces of TV actors who play cops, detectives, U.S. Marshals, deep-sea divers, spacemen, and spies. It's strange to see them in this setting, dressed in exquisite, elegant, continental-cut casuals. And then I see him, the actor who plays the detective in my favorite program. He's at the other end of the bar, wearing a beach hat with feathers, a loose-leaf blouse knotted at the stomach, a gold butterfly pinned to the hem of his slacks. He stands there, his body curved vampishly, one hand on his hip, scanning the bar regally. I approach. We talk for a while and move out onto the dance floor. Then we leave to go from one night spot to another and back finally to my place. We become friends. Spend our time together going to movies, plays, museums, restaurants. We vacation for 2 weeks in Haiti. He invites me to meet his parents, who live in New Jersey. He moves into my apartment because his mansion is being refurbished. We have the usual quarrels. One night, we have an argument after a party in a taxi. After storming out of the cab, provoked by something I've said, he begins to jab at me with his umbrella. I dodge this way and that, duck and swerve, evading his thrusts, fending him off with my portfolio. The cab driver watches in dismay, then drives off, running into a lamppost. Then I come home one evening to find that he's unsealed the trunk in my closet, revealing hundreds of small packets, a cache of heroin that I recently received from Hong Kong. He looks grim. I notice that he's discarded the beach hat, the bracelets, the gold butterfly, all his other effects, for a simple, understated blue suit. He tells me that I'll have to come downtown with him to be booked. I act surprised. I say that the trunk belonged to someone who visited here before him. I didn't have any idea what was in it. But I slowly make my way to my bureau drawer, where my gun is hidden. I tell him that I'll do anything he asks me to do. I pull out the drawer and grab the gun. I aim it at his chest. And I say, "I'm sorry, you had to find out. Now, I'll have to kill you." But as I say this, I suddenly feel a wave of terror, as if I'm trapped in a nightmare, that I've been programmed against my will to perform in a ritual, and that my next steps have been planned to the last detail. I try to claw my way out of sleep, but I realize that I am not dreaming. Then I hear my own voice say, "This is ridiculous! You're on television!" He shrugs his shoulders, throws a lamp at me, and dives behind the bed for cover. I fire at him! Then I run out the door, down the stairs, and into the street. He chases me down an alley, through the interior of an old abandoned warehouse, and up onto a rooftop. I pick up a tire iron and try to bash his brains out with it, but he puts it over his shoulder, and we wrestle at the edge of the roof, overlooking the traffic on a major street.
So, Hitler spent a weekend in Grindelwald, which is a quaint village on the border, and he had as his companion Eva Braun. And as you probably remember from the films, the old films, she was young, very pretty, and very much liked the outdoors. So they would go off together, and they would pick flowers and blackberries, and they would throw sticks for Hitler's dog, Wolf, to retrieve, and they would swim in secluded lakes. And then when they were drying themselves off, Wolf would come over to them, shake himself vigorously, spraying them with water, and they'd laugh and scold the dog good-humoredly. And then once a ladybug landed on Hitler's forearm, and she had four black spots on her back, and Hitler tried to remember if that meant she was 4 months or years old. And she started moving down to his wrist, and he turned his hand over, and she climbed around to his palm. And then she flew up, circled around him, and disappeared into the shade. And Hitler looked around, trying to see where she'd flown off to. But she was gone. Dostoevsky. Once said, "If God didn't exist, everything would be possible." It was the recognition of this moral void that led Germany on the road to nihilism. But Camus wrote in his letter to a German friend, Horst, that the Nazis had committed an error. Naturally, he, Camus, agreed with their premise that life was absurd. But on the contrary, the absurdity of the world, by definition, could only be affirmed by reference to a priori concepts of coherence and meaning. That human beings possessed meaning and value because they desired them. That our sense of loss at the absence of divine morality was grounded in a need for such values. The inescapable and irrefutable conclusion to be drawn was that human beings created values by their very despair in their not existing. God does not exist. Nietzsche was the first to recognize it. Over 100 years ago, he said, God is dead. Of course, the fact that he was a practicing atheist did color his judgment to some extent. And further, why should he, a teacher in a small school in the country, have been notified of God's death even before the Pope and the leading clerics of the world had been informed? This was a question that troubled many people. Nevertheless, he was arrested and held as an accessory after the fact. He was questioned. His house was raided by the police. After an exhaustive search, they found under his mattress a pair of lederhosen stained with gravy, beer, and Linzer tarts. Confronted with this startling new evidence, Nietzsche admitted that he hated his own body. And he was put under the care of Jung, who was a friend and disciple of Freud. Now, Freud said that the goal of therapy was to free us from our irrational impulses. Let ego be where it was. Let our consciousness be in control. He treated a kleptomaniac, a man who was overwhelmed by unconscious desires to steal. After 5 years of therapy, the man was cured. He became a rational thief. And by that time, Freud had nothing left. The man had made off with his glasses, his couch, his ferretization machine, and his soccer torts. He wired Jung for money. Jung sent him Nietzsche's lederhosen. Freud began to hate his own body. Now, according to Freud, the past determines the future. But now we know otherwise. The future determines the past. This has been proved by revisionist historians. And further, we should recognize that immortality can be found not in the future, but in the past. After all, the moment becomes eternal in the past. Nothing that has happened cannot happen. The past is indestructible. It is immortal. And that's my point. My youth is eternal, since it is eternally deposited in the past. So I'd say my idea of a good time is listening to Wagner's Siegfried with a stein of beer, a plate of bratwurst, a cup of sauerkraut, and a dumpling, and a peasant skirt, an accordion strapped to her belly, weeping as she listens to me lecture on the virtues of papaya. Blood and horse manure were always in the snow on the way to Grindelwald. They cleared them away every day, but there were too many horses then and tourists without accommodations, and it's hard work concentrating on fruit pits and chicken bones and grease stains without schnapps to wash down the aftertaste buds were in bloom that summer. When we went to Beirut and skidded in a spray of snow next to an empty table on the terrace, I'm not dead. A suicide might fall to the windshield of the groom, and you can expel your own heart if you want to, but it's hard work sniffing at a pair of arms and legs sticking out of a sandhill when kids are falling down elevator shafts and good Samaritans are killed breaking up fights and my lederhosen are stained with gummel. I'm not dead! Oh, I hate my own body, and I think God is, or he should be. But what can you do when nature beckons but disclaim responsibility? I was only a minor functionary following orders, yielding up my own interests to those of others. No, you go.
You take the tickets. You have a good time. It's all right. I don't count. Doesn't matter. I don't have to do anything because I'm on television. And nothing's real anyway. Except I've been turned into a dog. No. 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 I'm not dead. So I walked over to the doors of the subway car. The doors open. I stepped out of the platform, looked over my shoulder at the blind man. I was just trying to help. Walked up the stairs to 86th Street. Started walking down, going east, past Corona Condituri, the Bavarian Inn, the Habsburg Palace. Boy, it's good to be back in Yorkville again.
Joe Frank in Concert was recorded by Seal Muller and Manoli Weatherall, mixed by Greg Hedgepath. The musicians were Jesse Boggs, Larry Massett, Henry Dennis, and Van Williamson. Joe Frank in Concert was presented at Bushido in Manhattan, which is directed by Lisa Evers. Our special thanks to Brant Kingman, who arranged for the concert. Our thanks also to Amy Wong. This program was written and produced by Joe Frank. Executive producer Keith Talbot. If you would like a cassette copy of Joe Frank in Concert, please send $6 to Radio Experience, National Public Radio, Washington, D.C., 20036. The address again for your cassette copy of Joe Frank in Concert is Radio Experience, National Public Radio, Washington, D.C., 20036. And the price is $6. Funds for this Radio Experience special were provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.